Hello, and welcome to Nerd Critic, a podcast about movies from the dual perspective of critical nerdiness. My name is Jordan, and I am your studied and credentialed critic.
And my name is CJ, and I am your resident nerd.
This is an off-the-shelf episode, which means we pulled a movie off our digital or actual shelves, and we watched it so that we can talk about it, and we can have conversations. And I realized in my notes I failed to make a change and almost said the wrong movie, because today we're talking about The Shining.
We are indeed talking about The Shining.
Or The Shining, as it's commonly referred to.
So I'm a bit confused about this movie.
Okay.
Because it's considered one of the best movies of all time.
One of the best horror movies of all time.
I mean, sure. Yeah. Also on IMDb, it's, you know, top 60 or something.
I'm just throwing shade on the horror genre, I realize.
Sure. but it's I think it's Kubrick's only movie that there was zero Oscar nominations.
Well, we'll talk about that. We'll talk about why.
It's
going to be a little bit of a fun conversation.
Okay, cool. I'm excited about that.
I'm excited about that part of the conversation. But before we go on.
Yeah, yeah.
You admitted in our last episode, and perhaps before as well, that you...
I think I avoided it specifically. So it was probably just in the last episode. Because it's kind of an embarrassing thing. Like, hey, I review movies. And it's like, have you seen The Shining? No. That's not a great conversation to have.
Have you seen Citizen Kane?
I have seen Citizen
Kane.
There
you go. So you're fine.
Okay, good.
All right. So the reason we're doing The Shining is because Dr. Sleep is coming out this weekend. And it is a sequel to The Shining. I don't know yet whether it is a sequel to, and I maybe it's out there in PR materials, but I haven't researched it yet because I have been focused on The Shining and not Dr. Sleep. But so I don't know whether Dr. Sleep is a sequel to The Shining the movie or The Shining the book, because Dr. Sleep the book is a sequel to The Shining the book, which is a book written by Stephen King.
Yes.
So The Shining is probably the... probably famously the best Stephen King adaptation.
Sure.
I think that that's how it's known.
So you have in the notes that we should talk about the history, our history with this film.
Yes. So I'd like to start with you, CJ.
Okay. I don't have any. I've the history with the film, I have none.
Yeah. Well, your history of having not seen it.
Yeah, I never saw it.
But have you seen it yet?
I mean, yes, obviously I've seen it.
Well, then now you have history, don't you, CJ?
Well, like, history...
Do you know what history
is? Yes, it means anything that didn't happen right this second.
This second. So you are everything before this very moment is your history with the movie.
What I'm saying is I grew up and there was never any conversation about this movie.
That's fair.
And I knew the actor in it, but I didn't know. I always mixed this movie up with the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, sure.
And I just had no idea. And then I took my first film class, and we talked. You know, you talk about the classics. You talk about Citizen Kane. You talk about Psycho, and you talk about The Shining. And there was always, like, the beautiful scene of the blood coming in from the elevator. And it was like...
when whoa, spoilers.
All of that, right? And then there's the carpet. I also have seen Ready Player One, which has a bunch of The Shining references.
That's true.
So, like, that's the extent of my history. If I didn't have this podcast, I may have never seen this movie.
You know, I don't think that that's an unfair... statement or an unfair prediction. And I think this movie is if you are a person who appreciates horror movies and thinks about them in ways that are significant, if horror movies matter to you, then I feel like this is a movie you should see.
Yeah.
But definitely. If you're a person who is doesn't really care that much about horror movies or doesn't like them at all or whatever, then I don't think it's necessarily that important to see.
So let me tell you the experience I had with The Shining.
I'd love to hear it.
Okay. So there are some movies that are just famous, right? They are just really, really well-known movies for whatever reason. You're talking about the movies I just mentioned, plus like Jaws and Die Hard and stuff like that.
E.T. and E.T. pretty much most of the movies Spielberg did before the year 2000.
Indeed. And there are... There's a group of these movies that... So before my 20s, I hadn't seen pretty much any of these movies. I had seen the Indiana Jones and the Star Wars, right? Like the mega big ones.
Yeah.
But when you're talking some of the smaller ones, I hadn't seen them. And so... Over the past less than a decade, I have been diving into some of these classic movies, and I've realized that they fall into one of two buckets. Well, one of three buckets. One bucket being, I just don't like it. The other bucket being, I see why this movie was iconic. I appreciate everything that it is. But it's been done and duplicated so many times that, like, I'm a little sick of it. But I recognize that this was the first one. But so I recognize its place in film history, but meh. And then there's ones that I'm like, holy crap, that lived up to the hype and the expectation. Okay. I am going to just blaspheme here. You ready? In the meh pile is actually, oof, this is so hard to say. You
Maybe
ready?
You shouldn't say it.
I'm probably going
to
say it.
I mean, we want people to keep listening to this podcast.
I understand. I'm going to say it. I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to be unapologetic. Unapologetic. In the meh, The Godfather for me. Watched it and I was like, meh. Jordan is hiding in his shirt right now. But wait. Then I saw Godfather.
But wait, there's more.
But wait, there's more. If you call now, I loved Godfather 2. So I went back and watched Godfather 1, and I enjoyed it more because of Godfather 2.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
Then the other category of it's been duplicated, Die Hard fell into that. Love Die Hard, but I was like, I've seen like this. I see what this has inspired in film, and I've seen it done 800 times.
Yeah.
So I recognize it's like how iconic it is, but I've potentially seen it done elsewhere. Then there's the It Impressed. Even still, Casablanca lives in that bucket.
That's a fun movie.
Jaws lives in that bucket. Yeah. These movies that I'm like, dude, I've been hearing about this forever in film school from people, from friends, and it was still great. What bucket do you think The Shining is in?
I mean, before I answer your question,
okay,
I'd like to just give like a little pieces of my history with The Shining.
Okay.
Because I don't actually remember the first time I saw The Shining all the way through. Not because I was so young, but because I think it was so iconic. And I'd seen so many scenes. And I think probably at some point I saw it like as a teenager. And it's a movie that does more subconsciously for me than it does consciously. And so I sort of like it kind of like fairly quickly burrowed itself into my subconscious as one of the scariest movies I'd ever seen, but I couldn't tell you why.
Sure.
And then like when I watched it again, like, you know, later on in life, in my 20s or whatever, like I was like, yeah, this movie is not like super entertaining and it's not super scary most of the time, but like, boy, do I feel horrible as I'm watching it, and then especially later.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk a lot about why I think that is, and all of the things that are so deeply impressive about this movie, and why I appreciate it so much. But, like, so that said, because of the kind of movie this is, and because also I understand the way that people react to Kubrick's movies specifically, like 2001 and like The Shining, which are probably among the top most seen of his movies.
Definitely.
And
there are some Kubrick thumbprints on this movie.
People.
Boy, are there.
It may have been a movie that was clearly made by him. People tend, like regular people, tend not to like Kubrick's movies.
That's true.
And like, especially nowadays, especially like modern sensibilities. So I would not be surprised. This is a very long wind up to say, I would not be surprised if The Shining wound up in the meh pile.
Got it. I loved this movie.
That's great.
This movie, for me, absolutely lived up to the iconic status.
Oh, that's so great.
And it was terrifying. And I hated the way that I felt, but I loved it all at the same time. So I'm watching this movie, and one, I'm looking at Jack Nicholson thinking, oh, the Joker for sure. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like that, if people watched The Shining and then they were looking to cast the Joker, of course, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. This was almost a better Joker movie than the Joker was. Like, yes. So there was that. And he's just incredible. He's incredible.
Yeah.
So scary.
Yeah.
Also, the kid. Who was that kid? I loved him. He was great.
Yeah.
The moment that made me like that feeling of like, I don't like the way that I'm feeling. Mm-hmm.
It happens almost immediately in this movie for me now. Like, it's like the first shot, I'm like, I don't want to be here. I'm going to go to the other room.
Yeah. No, it happened. Like, I'm watching away, and it's like, generally, it's just like, oh, it's like, it's a ghost story. And I was like, oh, it's a ghost story, and you're just watching away. Until there's a very specific moment where.
Are we spoiling now?
Yes, spoiler warning.
Spoiler warning.
Spoiler warning moving forward. Where the kid, right? The kid is talking to the head chef.
Mm-hmm.
And the head chef is the one who claims it, The Shining. It's called The Shining, mm-hmm. this feeling. So you're introduced to this little finger puppet named Tony,
mm-hmm.
right? And Tony talks like this. And the kid talks, and they'll talk back and forth, and they'll keep going. And you're just like, haha, that's cute, little kid. And then they're like talking. It's like,
it's awful. CJ.
It's cute. Awful. When you're watching it and you have no context whatsoever, it's cute. It's fine. And it's like, oh, it's this kid's way to cope.
Your little imaginary finger puppet shouldn't talk like this. That's an awful way to talk. That says to me that I'm going to be really uncomfortable in this movie.
I was fine with it. Okay. I was fine with it until they start talking, and the chef is like, yeah, this is how long have you had this ability? Why don't you want to talk about it? And it's like, no, we call it The Shining. And he's like, you see, and you can talk to people, right? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, how long have you known about it? And then the kid goes, Tony told me about it, or ever since Tony, or whatever the reference to Tony was. And then suddenly, all of the cuteness that had happened before of him talking to this little finger puppet scared the living crap out of me. I then just realized, oh, that's either a demon or a dead person, and I don't like it. And I felt so uncomfortable from that point moving forward that I was like, it basically like
it primed you to be
afraid. Yeah. For the rest of the yeah. Movie, yeah. You know how like the position cats get in whenever they're threatened. I felt like my inner self
on
was
all
just like,
fours with your back arched, like watching the
all
movie,
the hair
like,
in the back of my neck was sticking up, and I was hissing at the
and
screen.
Your wife was like, "Why are you in that position?" Yeah. And you're just like,
"Exactly, that's exactly it." But yeah, it primed me to be terrified. And there were some cheesy moments, purely because of age, like this it's an older movie.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it was scary. It was eerie. I didn't like the feeling that I had, but I liked that it had that power over me.
Yeah.
And it was effective every step of the way.
That's so great, man.
Yeah.
I am so pleased. I feel like our work together on this podcast had made that possible.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Bam.
Yeah.
Nailed it.
Yeah.
Yes.
The weekly critic injections have made me able to appreciate.
You think this that kind CJ is building a metaphor here, but there are actual injections.
I have an IV in me right now.
He has the track marks on his arm to prove it.
Yeah.
So, this is great. Okay, this is a great place to start. I really, often we like talk ourselves blue about something and then we say, you know, this is why we do this podcast. But I want to say that like kind of at the more toward the front here and say that this is a movie that has so much to offer and is doing so many things so carefully and is such a really a monument of filmmaking that I hope to death that people kind of, you know, that I hope that the work that we do with Nerd Critic to try to like help people, bring people in on this sort of joyful conversation of film in like a really accessible way, helps give people access to this kind of movie.
Yeah.
Because it is so richly rewarding if you can show up for it. Mm-hmm. It so has, it's just, oh my gosh, it's incredibly dynamic. So let's talk about, you said it scared you all the way through, which I think is wonderful.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of jump scares in this movie. So I want to ask you, why did it scare you?
I think kind of what we were talking about in that it put me in a place
of dread.
Yeah. And it was just all of the slow burn. And also I think potentially the reputation, and so like, cause there's a bunch of shots of you following the kid on the tricycle through the hallways.
Mm-hmm.
Every time that popped up, I was like, I don't want to be here. I know those little girls are around one of these corners, and it does it like four times before you actually land on those girls. And it's really quite freaky when it happens. But this overall, I think the reason that it was that there's that feeling of dread and that it was so scary for me is because it was discussing very psychological things. It didn't really feel like there was a physical threat, nor did at the end when there is a physical threat, I didn't feel scared of it. I kind of knew what was going to happen, but it was this psychological unknown that made me feel so uncomfortable that it was scary. And like the skeleton, like the woman sees the skeletons and it's like, oh, that's scary. That didn't land.
Mm-hmm.
But Jack Nicholson going to the empty bar and starting a conversation with himself that becomes this elaborate party makes me feel so uncomfortable that I don't even know what to do with myself. So it was this kind of overall feeling of dread.
The possibility of terror and violence and murder in this movie it's a movie that is like so soaked in blood without actually being bloody.
Yeah.
Like I think one of the coolest scenes, and you know this is the obvious kind of like the shot that is that one of the shots that Shining is so famous for of the blood like coming, you know, just the waterfall or the bloodfall.
Were you disappointed in yourself when you thought of that?
I am.
I don't know what that face was.
I was disappointed in my inability to communicate an idea without resorting to some stupid word like bloodfall. Anyway, this huge outpouring of blood that fills the hallway and, you know,
like to the point that it like moves furniture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It to me, that's kind of like, that's the thing that you subconsciously know is there all the time.
Mm.
And so when you see that, you're like, well, I knew that that's what was happening. I knew that everything was soaked in blood. And like, you don't know why.
Yeah.
You don't know why other than that the most terrifying thing is for a father to go crazy and kill his family. Like that, like, So it's like we're not talking about body count here.
No.
We're not talking about that at all. Mm-hmm. We're talking about psychological terror of like of possibility, of unrealized potential for violence and horror. And like you don't know what it's going to be and you don't know how it's going to be, but you know it's coming like inevitably, and that drives you crazy.
Yeah, and when they get close to it, but then pull back. It just feels like torture. Like when this the only like the full grown man who's already kind of a dick just loses his temper. It's so tense. Like there's not a muscle in your body that is relaxed because you don't know what he's going to do. Cause you're like, you're already kind of unstable. You're starting to talk to yourself. You're starting to see things. Are you possessed? Are you just crazy? And you just don't know. And it's so like annoyingly uncomfortable, but oddly satisfying. It's hard to articulate. But like, and then at the major spoilers at the very, very end, when it zooms into the photo, and you recall that he was like, yeah, I feel like I've been here before. And it zooms into the photo, and it's him in 1921 at this hotel. You have no idea what that means.
Yeah.
It's just like, is he reincarnated? Is he living the same life? Is it a son? Is it the same person? You have no idea. And then it just leaves you in that feeling of like, that's kind of messed up. Live with that.
Yeah, the end.
Yeah. And it's a perfect way to end it, because it's, you just don't like it. You don't like the feeling. Like, maybe once or twice in my lifetime will I go back to this movie.
Yeah.
It's not something that I'm like, it's so good, I want to watch it tomorrow. It's just like, I want to stay away from it. But like, it was a very specific itch that it scratched.
I feel very scorched by this movie. Like, I don't feel the need to go back and watch it hardly ever, because it's like all the things that it was supposed to do, it did, and they're not going to go away.
Yeah.
like after I watched this movie, it's like, I know, like, both times that I've seen this movie, it's like, I know that I'm not going to be very afraid while I'm watching the movie. I'm going to feel very uncomfortable and like a lot of that dread and that awful feeling. But then I'm going to have nightmares.
Yeah.
I'm just going to straight up have nightmares for like a while. Yeah. And like that reality like is, I think nightmares may be my least favorite thing in life. I'm not interested in motivating my subconscious to serve me nightmares. So very few movies do that for me. Very, very few movies do that for me. Movies that I think would be like, I was very frightened during the movie Haunt.
Yeah.
I was very frightened. Yeah. I was like, I was feeling a lot of suspense. And then there were lots of moments that were really awful and it was a scary movie.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any nightmares. It was fine.
Yeah.
I had all the scary stuff happened during the movie. But with The Shining, I feel like all the scary stuff happens after the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's I saw It and mm-hmm. It 2, deathly afraid of clowns. I think I had one nightmare, but it wasn't bad. This movie is more likely to leave me with nightmares than any of the other horror movies that I've seen.
Absolutely. So let's talk about...
Because it's psychological.
Let's talk about why.
Because it's psychological.
Oh, sorry. I asked the question too late. Yeah. You're right. All right. The end.
The end. There we go.
All right. So, okay. First of all, a little bit of history. So, the critical reception of this movie was not great at first. In fact, it was like lukewarm at best. Like, people were like, this was not successful. This was weird. What is wrong with you, Stanley Kubrick? You made a bad movie. Bad job. Yeah. Go home. Like, people did not like it. A lot of people thought it was like really, really underwhelming. I mean, even like Roger Ebert was like, nope, pass. You know,
fascinating.
Like, people really didn't like it. And apparently the reason they didn't like it was because at the time the expectations for horror movies were that they would be like very violent and suspenseful and action-packed in some way. Like, it would move quickly and it would do a lot of things. And
this movie does not move quickly.
Does not do any of that.
Yeah.
It's very slow. And so because people went to the movie expecting and Stephen King, by the way, is a very pulpy writer. Stephen King writes page turners. Stephen King does not write contemplative literary fiction. He writes page turners. He's a great writer. I think Stephen King is a fantastic writer, and he's a thoughtful writer, and he's a very he's an incredibly talented writer in a full spectrum way, but he doesn't write books that are hard to read. He writes books that are fast and action-packed and page-turning. You cannot put a Stephen King book down. That's why he's Stephen King.
Yeah.
That's why he's like the most successful and wealthy author ever, because he's so good at doing that. And so when people go see a Stephen King adaptation of a horror movie, like a horror Stephen King horror book made into a horror movie by one of the more well-known filmmakers at the time, they're expecting certain things.
Yeah, absolutely.
They didn't get those things, and they were mad. And so it took a little while for people. Like, it was like up to like, you know, 5 to 10 years later that people could generally started to agree that it was a great movie. Like,
wow, that's fascinating.
Which is really interesting. It ended up making its money back, but like not much better. It was not a blockbuster. It was not like, as you pointed out at the beginning, did not win a lot of awards.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting. So I'd like to make a quick comparison to an entirely inappropriate movie. Or in it, I'd like to make a quick, entirely inappropriate comparison. And that is to the movie Nacho Libre.
Oh, interesting.
Because Nacho Libre, I believe, was a comedy ahead of its time. And it got pretty good reviews. People liked it. A lot of people didn't like it at first. And then now it's like a cult classic.
That is me. I did not like it at first.
There you go. I didn't either.
Yeah.
I was on a date.
Oh,
and my
really?
Date hated it.
No.
And so I was like, it was stupid.
It sucked.
And then I literally thought it sucked. And then I went back to see it again later. I was like, oh, this might be the best comedy of all comedies.
It was, for me, that movie was, I didn't like it. And then someone would quote it and I'd be like, that's funny. And then it would happen again and again. And then I'd be like, wait, I think all that's funny. Let me go back to watch the movie. And then I love the movie.
And it is an exquisite comedy.
Yeah.
And that, I feel like that's my real life example of what I believe happened to people during, like, when The Shining came out. And this is not a terribly uncommon story. Actually, it's the same story with 2001. 2001 might be another, like, maybe the most famous Stanley Kubrick movie.
No question.
2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
That was like an even more extreme example where it was like panned. People were like, boo, that movie sucked. Like, what a boring, weird movie. That guy shouldn't make any more movies.
Yeah.
And then fast forward and it's like one of the biggest classics of all time. Like,
yeah.
It is a profoundly good movie. Anyway, I digress. Point is, this happened to The Shining. And I would like to... point out what it takes to make truly important art. I think that sometimes you have to accept that people will hate you.
Yeah.
And will hate your work.
Yeah.
And that you just have to hope that maybe they get it eventually. And maybe they won't. Stanley Kubrick got lucky a couple of times. And people got it eventually. But
this is not the time to bring this up. But I'm going to do it anyway because I'm
I just talked about Nacho Libre right next to The Shining. So I think you're allowed.
Is that what's you think going to happen to The Last Jedi?
Oh, that's not the right time. This is not the right time.
We'll talk about that later.
We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
All right. So,
how many times have we brought up The Last Jedi and said, we'll talk about it later this entire year? And then we're pushing the whole show. And we're pushing it off to December.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
You're welcome.
Any luck, it'll build anticipation nicely for us.
Be a good conversation.
Yeah. All right. So... do you know what auteur theory is at all? Like, could you give us a one line?
Not a chance.
Not at all?
Not at all.
Have you heard the term auteur theory?
I've heard the term auteur, okay. And I've heard the term theory,
well, so,
but not together.
Well, you've heard the term auteur, so do you know what an auteur is?
Yes.
What is it?
It is the way that I see it is that it is the, artist that is into something, into making something for what a lot of people see as kind of pretentious, but like the for the art of it,
okay.
For art's sake.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So the literal definition of auteur is author because it's author in French.
No, sure.
So auteur is auteur theory is a French, originated in France. I'm going to do a bad job of this. I apologize in advance. Anyone who is an actual film criticism, like an actual film crit, like person with like a master's or a PhD in film criticism will hate me by the end of this, but I'm going for it anyway.
Do it.
I got my master's in screenwriting, not theory. So suck it. Anyway. Like the auteur theory came to us from French filmmakers who were very pretentious, but also very good. Like, France is the birthplace of like many of cinema's greatest achievements, and so like France is kind of like it. When you go like into deep film theory, like France came up with like, I won't say all of it, but like they came up with so much that we like rely on today without even knowing it. And France was very proud of its cinema traditions, very, very proud of its cinema traditions, also very proud of the auteur theory, which it generated. And the auteur theory goes that there is in a body of work by a director, you can find the director. You can see the auteur. You can see the author of the movie, and that a movie is more than anything the product of a single brilliant mind.
Okay,
that's auteur theory, and so
it's a little pretentious.
Yes, it's exceptionally pretentious. I, for the record, hate auteur theory.
Sure,
I think it's a load of bunk. However, if we're talking about Stanley Kubrick, I think it's easier to make a case with Stanley Kubrick as an auteur than like with most other filmmakers.
There's maybe a handful of filmmakers that come to mind.
Yeah.
Even so, Stanley Kubrick probably tops that list.
Yeah, and I would say even so, I still think it's a bad theory. I still think that Stanley Kubrick isn't an auteur in the way that the French would consider an auteur, because I don't think anybody is. Because I think if you go make a movie, you need a team of exceptionally talented people, and you can't do any of your crap without a bunch of these people working their butts off to make your vision come true.
Yeah.
And in the process of working their butts off, they're going to contribute to your vision, and your vision will change based on the manifestation of your vision depends entirely upon the people making it. So that's my short speech about why auteur theory sucks. But to make the case for Stanley Kubrick as the closest thing that we'll probably as Americans ever get to an auteur, I'd like to point out a few things about this movie.
Do it.
Okay. First of all, When Stephen King was apparently, this is off of Wikipedia.
Okay.
I did a lot of reading, and it turns out, as is the usual with exceptionally popular topics, Wikipedia is a very rich data mine. Stephen King was told that Kubrick had his staff bring him stacks of horror books because he wanted to do a horror movie next. He was like really interested in doing a horror movie as his next movie, and he tried to read them all. And apparently Stephen King said Kubrick's secretary heard the sound of each book hitting the wall as the director flung it into a reject pile after reading the first few pages. And then finally, one day, the secretary noticed it had been a while since she'd heard the thud of another writer's work being tossed against the wall. So she went in to check, and it turned out that he was really engrossed in The Shining. So that's...
Yeah. Okay. Great.
So here we go. We have the great picture of a director... saying, garbage, trash, bring me my X-ray.
Kind of a caricature of a director.
Yeah, I love that. In his search to find the right actor to play Danny, the kid, he sent people to Chicago, Denver, and Cincinnati to create an interview pool of 5,000 boys over a six-month period looking for the right kid with the right accent that fell between Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall.
Wow.
That's a Kubrick move.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
That's a lot.
Like, nobody does meticulous the way he does meticulous. Like, this guy is...
Wes Anderson, maybe?
Maybe. Honestly, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know. His rate of filmmaking is higher, so I don't know if he has the time to quite pull a Kubrick.
That's fair.
The production schedule of The Shining, the principal photography reportedly took over a year
to complete
because of how many times he did every single thing.
That's wild.
Like, yeah. Anyway, for instance, Joe Turkel, who played the bartender, in an interview, he talked about rehearsing the bar scene for 6 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
And that on the shoot day, it lasted from 9 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. So 13 and a half hours of shooting with him. And that
it's a good scene.
He was just covered in sweat.
It's a really good scene.
It is a really good scene. And they rehearsed it for 6 months.
That
scene for 13 hours, which is insane.
Yeah.
Because it's just dialogue.
Yeah.
And like, so that's Kubrick. And in the final gold room sequence, apparently Kubrick instructed the extras via a megaphone not to talk, but to mime conversations to each other, because he knew from years of scrutinizing thousands of films that extras could often mime their business by nodding and using large gestures that looked fake. So he told them to act naturally and give the scene to in order to give the scene a chilling sense of time-gripping realism as Jack walks from the 70s into the roaring 20s, which is one of the reasons the film is so haunting, because it never breaks that sense of, like, deep, like, realism.
Yeah.
Like, you were there, and it sucks because it's real.
Yeah.
And, so he knew. He knew how to, like, make that happen with those, anyway, those extras. Anyway.
I noticed one little trick. I was going to say, I don't know if this was on purpose, but it kind of sounds like it probably was if he was this meticulous about it. But I noticed a bunch of scenes where it was a nearly completely symmetrical shot, which a lot of filmmakers do, but Kubrick does that quite a bit, right? The kid going down the hallway, it just stays in the center the whole time. But there was a bunch of scenes, specifically the scenes that the dad was in, where it was supposed to be symmetrical, but there was one thing that was just barely off center. And for example, the very beginning, when he goes in to talk to the guy, basically do the job interview to be able to hotel sit for the winter, there's a shot. You got a guy in front of the desk, in front of a chair, on the other side, in front of the chair, dead center. The man behind the desk is sitting dead center of the shot. There's a wall on each side. There's a desk in the middle. And then the window behind him is just off center. And you're like, ooh, this is like almost normal, but that bothers me. And then there's another scene where what's Jack Nicholson's character's name in this?
Jack. No.
Oh, Jack. It is Jack.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll work no play makes Jack a dull boy.
Which he apparently found idioms in like 8 other languages to record that scene in.
Wow.
Like, and just ended up using that one. But like, yeah.
Wow. Anyway. Yeah. So when he's in like the big grand hall, I guess, and he's typing and he's writing, everything is perfectly symmetrical and centered, except for him sitting in his chair, barely off center. And it's so annoying to the eye. You see it and you're like, ugh, that bothers me. But like, I looking back on it, I realize how perfect it was.
100% on purpose.
Because it was like this feeling of unease or annoyance or like something's not quite right. It doesn't feel... It like looks good, but what is it that's different? And if you didn't have kind of an eagle eye on it, you wouldn't be able to place it. You would just know, you would look at it and be like, ew, something's bothering me. And that's this entire movie. The entire movie, not necessarily visually, I'm talking tonally, the whole thing just bugs you. And it's like, ooh, I don't like it. I don't like it. And that's how these scenes were. And I thought that was a brilliant choice. It was a brilliant choice.
I'm gonna call out one more thing that might blow your mind, because it always blows my mind every time I think of it, or every time when I first heard about it, I didn't quite understand it because I wasn't paying attention. And then when I started paying attention, I was like, oh my gosh, it's crazy. And then I read more about it just now, as I was doing a little research for this episode, and my mind is like even more blown. And that is that the way the set was constructed, it was built to not work spatially. So there are a number of impossible things. For instance, there's no room. If you see the hotel from the exterior shot, there is no possible way that it's big enough to contain all of the things that we see inside of it.
Hmm.
Like, not even close.
Hmm.
It's like anyway. And like all the scenes that you see where you are spatially oriented are built in such a way that like the things you see in the scene don't work. Like they're impossible. Like a window where there's a room surrounded by hallways, you know?
Oh,
like there's no way, right? But it just is anyway.
Yeah.
And like that also 100% on purpose.
Yeah.
Like meticulously planned. They built this set from scratch. It was one of the biggest sets that was ever built at the studio. And like everything is so intentional.
Yeah.
Like in filmmaking, everything should be intentional, but like in realistically, you kind of have to say, okay, we'll get this, we'll do this, you know, we got to move on. Right?
Yeah.
Kubrick does not move on. until everything is exactly the way that he wanted it to be.
I mean, the fact that this movie takes place in such a large, it is scary. If you've ever been in a giant building entirely by yourself, it's scary.
Yeah.
It's so freaky. Oh, yeah. And your mind starts to play tricks on you. It's already
scary.
It's already scary. And if you get in your head, and it doesn't have to be a large area. It can be in your house at nighttime when you're like, oh, it happens to me all the time. I'm like, oh, you know, it's just I'm walking in the dark and my mind's just like clowns. And I was like, what? No.
I don't want to
think about that. And then suddenly every noise kind of freaks you out. You know what I mean? So like the fact that this movie takes place in such a big place, it's already kind of creepy. And then as far as the characters are specifically Jack, it's like, it's almost like it's a large place to play, but you feel suffocated, and it's kind of like what his mind is. His mind as a writer, large place to play, but you kind of feel suffocated because of
trapped.
You feel trapped.
Leave.
And it's just like I feel like the more I think about this movie, the more those meticulous little details pop out.
Yeah.
And it makes it so good.
Yeah.
And it just gets better and better.
It's quite a movie. I feel like once again we're discussing a movie that we could go on for a long time about.
Yeah.
we could probably go on for at least two or three times the amount of time we've already spent. We could continue talking. There's like so many thoughts that I've had. Like I want to go back. Oh yeah, I was gonna say this. But I honestly just wanna say hats off to Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
And like his. I don't know. Filmmakers like him are like kind of once a generation. But I think honestly, it's almost like once a medium. Like I don't think we're gonna have any more
Kubrick's
mm-hmm. making movies.
Yeah.
You know, we may have that level of like just obsessive neurotic attention to detail in other media, maybe.
Sure.
Certainly I would say. But like when it comes to filmmaking is not a medium. It is not a medium that I think lends itself anymore to that kind of attention to detail.
Yeah.
Especially not with like studio support, you know.
Definitely
like,
not.
No one's gonna let someone like Kubrick make a movie like The Shining and spend a year filming it. Like it's not gonna happen.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And the human rights abuses that he inflicted on his actors.
Yeah.
Like it's just not gonna happen. And so you know, there's really something to say. There's something to be grateful for that, like his movies even exist at all.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll be watching The Shining again, ever. I don't know if I need to.
Yeah. I mean, I probably will. I could actually see.
But the real miracle for me is that I don't even need to.
Yeah.
For it to have had a lifelong impact.
Yeah, yeah. I don't need to watch it again, but it would be, if I do, it would be an introduction to somebody else. Be like, oh, we need to watch this movie.
No, that's,
outside of that, it's never going to be a Friday night and I'm going to be like, you know what I feel like watching? The Shining.
Yeah,
that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
Because it's just such an unpleasant feeling. Yeah, there is more to say.
But I'm glad. I'm glad that it exists. I'm glad that I've seen it. I'm glad that I've had the experiences I've had with it, because it is an example of something that is doing so much more than other movies like it have ever really been able to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I have to ask, if anybody ever asks me what's the scariest movie I've ever seen, it's The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
It's always going to be The Shining.
I would probably agree with that. Yeah. There was one fact that you said that I have to correct you on.
Oh, please, please.
I'm
do.
Pretty sure J.K. Rowling is the most successful author of all time. She's the first first author to be worth $1 billion.
Okay.
Just for the Harry Potter fans, I had to give credit where credit's due.
Just to make everyone hate me before the end of the episode.
Please do.
Stephen King is not only a better writer and author than J.K. Rowling, he is a logarithmically better writer and author than J.K. Rowling.
I honestly don't know if you'll have a lot of people disagree with
by
you.
By a factor of
a lot.
A lot.
I mean, I don't think
it's hard to put a number on it.
You'll have the very biased Harry Potter fans, but I think there's an understanding that Harry Potter is specifically Harry Potter, and as far as like quality of writing, there
I also
gets
think
surpassed.
That Stephen King has had I think Stephen King has more fans, but I don't think that's actually true.
No.
Dang it.
Harry Potter is huge.
You're a bummer. This is not a podcast about J.K. Rowling. This is a podcast about Stephen King and Stanley Kubrick and The Shining.
This is a podcast where we get our facts right, Jordan.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
Except for when we screw up.
Then it doesn't count. That rule doesn't apply.
All right.
Join us for our discussion on Terminator Dark Fate on Friday, Wednesday, for you nerd critic to the max subscribers. If you don't know what that is, go back and listen to one of our other episodes, because you shoot in the dark and we're probably going to talk about it.
MLA.com/nerdcritic.
Yep. A couple of dollars and you get so much. Other than that, I think we're good.
I think we are good. I think we're so good at this. Get in touch if you'd like. Any way, anyhow. We are always happy to receive communications from you guys.
Always.
And share this show with your friends.
Yeah, and if you're a Star Wars fan, look forward to the upcoming events.
Oh yeah, it's gonna be a wild end of year celebrations for us. This episode in particular, I would love people to share this episode with their friends who love horror movies.
Yeah.
So that they can make fun of us.
Yeah, for how little we know.
For how little we know about horror movies.
It is a bit of a gap. Although that gap is being filled in little by little.
Little by little.
Share with your horror fans. I mean, yeah. I'm trying to figure out when this is coming out. No, it's gonna be after Halloween.
It's after Halloween.
But it's before Dr. Sleep.
We celebrated a lot of Halloween stuff before October, and now we're celebrating some Halloween stuff after October. We just kind of, we just sort of widely missed the mark.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And then last but not least, thank you, Michael Bonomo, for the wonderful music.
Yes, thank you indeed. And remember, everyone, to collect movies like a nerd and rewatch them like a critic.
And cut.